Welcome to your weekly Constitutional, a radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS HD1 and WETS 89.5 FM in Johnson City, Tennessee. Well, I was reading the obits again recently, and a lion of the right has passed. One of the great conservatives of the last 30 years, a hero to many, a bane to others. His name was Robert Bork. And in just a minute here, I'm going to be speaking to a couple of very knowledgeable people about the infamous or famous Senate confirmation process which led to Robert Bork's rejection all those years ago and which has been such a bone of contention in all the ensuing decades. We're also going to hear from another fellow who has a different perspective on that particular process. But in the meantime, I have my former student and now practicing attorney, Joni Burrows, class of 11, with me.
Hello.
And Joni is going to give us a little bit of background, especially for perhaps our younger listeners. Who was this fellow, Robert Bork?
Well, Robert Bork was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His dad was named Harry, and he was a steel company purchasing agent. Mm-hmm. His mother, Elizabeth, was actually a school teacher. He was married first to Claire Davidson from 1952 until 1980, and she unfortunately passed away from cancer. And then in 1982, he married somebody named Mary Ellen Pohl, who was I believe, a former Catholic nun turned activist.
I see.
He attended the Hotchkiss School in Lakeville, Connecticut.
One of those Hotch schools, yes.
One of those Hotch schools.
Okay.
And earned both his bachelor's degree and his law degree from the University of Chicago. Mm. He passed the bar.
Very well-respected school, but also, and I think this is a bit of foreshadowing, known for somewhat conservative economic theories. But go on, please.
Yes, yes. He passed the bar in Illinois and served for a time in the United States Marine Corps, and actually worked in private practice from 1954 until he got asked to be a Yale Law School professor in 1962, where he stayed until 1975 and then came back and taught again from 1977 till 1981. He actually was able to teach the Clintons while he was
Bill and Henry were students of Robert Bork?
Yes, yes, they were.
Well, isn't that an interesting irony? All right.
Yes. And as most of your listeners probably know, he eventually went on to be a Solicitor General in the United States Department of Justice.
That's the guy who argues all the government's cases in front of the Supreme Court, or at least
yes.
His office does. So
yes.
That's no slouch position.
Absolutely not. He is also a U.S. Circuit Judge.
Wait. You skipped over something here. I think it was when he was Solicitor General
yes.
that he first came to public notice. What did he do as Solicitor General?
He had a major role in the Saturday Night Massacre.
The Saturday Night Massacre. Now, that
yes.
was when Richard Nixon was under the gun from the special prosecutor. What was the special prosecutor's name?
Archibald Cox.
Archibald Cox. And Nixon ordered his Attorney General to fire Archibald Cox.
Yes.
And who was that Attorney General? That was
Elliot Richardson.
Elliot Richardson. Elliot Richardson said, well, Mr. President, he's supposed to be independent and he's just doing his job, so I respectfully refuse and resign. And so
yes.
then it went to William Ruckelshaus.
Yes.
And he did?
The same thing.
Same thing. And then who was third in line at
that,
Justice?
That would be Mr. Bork.
And did Mr. Bork similarly fall on his sword and say that would be inappropriate, Mr. President?
No, he did not.
In fact, he very quickly said, sure.
Yes, get him out of here.
Get him out of here. And fired Archibald Cox. And
yes.
That act earned him the ire of the left mm-hmm. and the loyalty of the right. Okay, so he was the guy who actually did the massacring on Saturday
yes.
night. Okay.
He was the executioner himself, I guess.
I see, the axe man. All right.
And then he did go on to be the United States Circuit Judge for the District of Columbia from 1982 to 1988.
Mm-hmm.
While he was sitting as circuit judge, I believe is when he got nominated for the Supreme Court.
Right, now 1982 to 88 indicates he was a Reagan appointee.
Yes.
Okay, so he was, after Jimmy Carter's interlude in the late 70s, of course the conservatives were back in office with Reagan, and apparently Bork was a greatly admired by Reagan, so he put him on the D.C. Circuit, which is no slouch circuit. Nope. I mean, a lot of Supreme Court justices come from there.
Yes.
Okay, so he's serving for several years, 5 or 6 years, on the D.C. Circuit, and then we get to the crux of the matter, don't we? What happened
yes.
then?
He got nominated for the Supreme Court of the United States by uh-huh. President Reagan, and was turned down for that job by
yes.
the Congress.
He was, in fact, borked.
Yes,
was he, not?
He was borked.
To use the nomenclature of the right, he
yes.
was rejected, and people are still arguing to this day over the propriety of that rejection.
Yes, they are.
Well, thank you very much, Joni Burrows, for filling us in on that. Let's just finish the thought, though. I mean, we know, and we've already given away the ending, he was rejected. What did he do after he was rejected? I mean, he didn't just die and curl up in a fetal position.
Surprisingly, no. He actually resigned his job as a U.S. Circuit Judge, U.S. Court of Appeals Judge, mm-hmm. And went to work as a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research, mm-hmm. which is a conservative think tank.
Right.
And he also consulted for Netscape during the Microsoft litigation that they went through.
Right. He was a big antitrust lawyer, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
And he was, in fact, he thought that those monopolies, those so-called trusts, were not such a bad thing.
No,
right?
He had no problem with them, I guess. He was also worked as a fellow for the Hudson Institute and served as a visiting professor at the University of Richmond Law School and had a couple other, I guess, teaching and consulting gigs.
He didn't go away.
No, he did not.
He remained and really sort of reveled in being the darling of the right for
yes.
many, many years. So in fact, I seem to recall he was an advisor to the Romney campaign.
He was indeed.
So he's been in there right to the bitter end and
yes.
then passed away just recently.
Yes, he did.
Okay, well now, thank you, Joni. Mm-hmm. I appreciate your time telling us about Robert Bork. Well, next to we're going to talk with a fellow who brought to my attention recently by an op-ed piece he did, and his name is David Greenberg. He's an associate professor at Rutgers. Actually, he holds several appointments. He's a professor of journalism, professor of media studies, professor of history. I think he's got a PhD in history from Columbia. He's written about a wide variety of things. He's got a background in journalism, of course, before he did that. And recently wrote a piece about the Bork nomination process, putting it into historical context. And I can't resist those things. Whenever I see somebody taking something that controversial and trying to put it into a wider context, I just gravitate to it. So I gave David a call recently, and we spoke on the telephone. And now let's share our interview with David Greenberg of Rutgers.
I wrote about this specifically with reference to Supreme Court justices, although people also now use the term for any presidential nomination that gets challenged aggressively by members of Congress, by various public interest groups representing one, interest or another, or the, segments of the public. And there's an implication that Borking, one, that it began with the Supreme Court nomination of Robert Bork, which is untrue, and two, that it's somehow an unfortunate or lamentable development, as opposed to an exercise of Congress's legitimate constitutional function.
David, you just reminded... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but something really just occurred to me. Do you remember that old book from the 1950s, Advise and Consent? Did you ever read that?
Oh, yeah, Alan Drury, reporter turned novelist, right?
Right, Advise and Consent. It was an entire book, an entire novel, a big novel, and I think it even won the Pulitzer Prize, about the process that the Senate goes through when considering at least a nominee for Secretary of State. So this is a process that is a very serious process, and in fact, it's even sponsored an entire best-selling novel.
That's right. That's a good point. And so the question arises, why have people come to think of this as Congress overreaching or engaging in nasty politics? And, of course, a lot of the rhetoric used during the Bork fight was heated, and some people would say exaggerated. I'm not convinced of that myself. I think had Bork been, instead of Anthony Kennedy, who is now kind of the swing vote on the Supreme Court, had we had Robert Bork there instead, we probably would have had a lot of decisions going different ways over the last 25 years or so. So in any event, there's a notion that this kind of heated, aggressive challenge is somehow wrong. Yeah, people recognize that obviously the Senate does have to confirm, and that we're a little less clear on what that advice role means. But I think they still, you know, in our own times, we have come to see the president as so important that the president is kind of expected to get his way.
Mm-hmm.
And challenges still strike us as a kind of unfortunate or regrettable assertiveness from Congress rather than just a part of the process.
Maybe this is a phenomenon that's linked to the general increase in the president's powers over the last 40 or 50 years as compared to the other two branches of the federal government.
Well, exactly. And one thing I have written about, and I tried to write about succinctly in this short op-ed, is that starting in the early 20th century, really with the presidencies of Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, even to some degree a little bit before that with William McKinley, the presidency did gain in power and stature. And as far as Supreme Court nominations went, in the 19th century, it had been quite common for Congress to reject court appointments, not to act on them, and kind of administering something like a president's pocket veto, where they just would let the nominations die. Between 1894, I think it is, or sometime in the 1890s, when the last of these went down, and the late 1960s, only one Supreme Court nominee was defeated by Congress, John J. Parker, a Hoover nominee. So it was during that period that we saw the great ascent of presidential power. Now, the presidency remains very strong, but you saw in the late 60s various challenges to political authority, and I think encouraged a new assertiveness on the part of Congress, first actually by conservatives, Southern Democrats and Republicans challenging Lyndon Johnson, and then when the tables were turned, by liberals and Democrats challenging Nixon and Reagan.
I located the
Bork nomination in that context.
Okay, good. Well, let's actually go through some of those. So we've got the 19th century when conflict was common, when Congress was actually
right.
much more powerful with respect to the presidency. Then we got the 20th century where there's that long quiet period where there's not a lot of challenges to these. But then when the 60s come around and people start distrusting the president again, thanks to Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon, people start challenging the president again. So this is really the pendulum kind of going back and forth, as it so often does in so many political and constitutional issues. But let's talk about specifically Lyndon Johnson's challenges with the Supreme Court nominations.
Okay, yes, this is where I think sort of the modern period of contentiousness really begins. Obviously, Lyndon Johnson did enjoy a majority of his own party of Democrats in the Senate and in the Congress as well. But many of these Democrats were from the South and quite conservative on a lot of issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so Johnson could get them into line for some of his social programs, but it was much harder on issues relating in particular to race. And in the 1960s, actually even in the 1950s, the Supreme Court under Chief Justice Earl Warren had been ruling in a much more liberal and expansive direction. And so Southern senators led by Strom Thurmond and others decided to fight back by telling Lyndon Johnson, we are not going to accept your nominees to the Supreme Court. So when Thurgood Marshall, who had been the Solicitor General under LBJ, and before that, obviously, an extremely accomplished litigator, litigated many of the key NAACP lawsuits for racial equality before the court. When Marshall comes up for the Supreme Court, Strom Thurmond and many of the other conservatives refused to support the nomination. They impugn his intelligence. They impugn his qualifications. They subject him to these kind of demeaning quizzes on details of passage of the 14th Amendment, because, of course, he was, something of an expert on the subject, so they tried to poke holes in his claims to expertise. Now, this didn't work in the case of Thurgood Marshall, but it did set a precedent that Congress, the Senate in this case, was not going to be as docile as it had typically been for much of the previous 60 or 70 years.
Now, before we leave Thurgood Marshall, you make a really important point in your op-ed piece, is that many of these conservative Southern senators were questioning Marshall's qualifications, which was patently absurd. I mean, he was, at that time, the Solicitor General, which is, the official in the Justice Department who's in charge of making Supreme Court arguments. And before that, he was among the most qualified constitutional litigators in the country. I mean, he'd argued a number of these very important cases. So, I mean, it would have
exactly, before the Supreme Court.
Right. And so it wasn't just that Congress was asserting itself, Congress was asserting itself in ways that were very aggressive, very politically motivated, and arguably lacked any kind of justification.
Well, what's interesting also is the language of expertise starts to enter into it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we also enter, even though things are becoming more partisan, we also have a more technocratic society, a society in which, for example, the American Bar Association had begun to issue ratings of Supreme Court nominees. So there was a conceit that, this wasn't about your ideology. This was about how qualified you are. And I saw an article in the paper the other day about the fact that all our Supreme Court justices have gone to Harvard or Yale Law School. This is part of our current emphasis on expertise. And so even some recent cases of nominees that failed to make it onto the bench, such as George Bush's friend Harriet Myers, were challenged on the grounds of expertise because it's seen as a way of defeating someone you're ideologically opposed to without just coming out and saying, I don't like your politics.
Right,
and in a way, that's what they were trying to do with Marshall. It wasn't a very convincing effort, but that's what they were trying to say. Oh, no, it's not that we don't like, his views on race. It's that we don't think he's suited to be a Supreme Court justice. But, of course, in Marshall's case, that didn't wash.
Right. I think you're right. I think currently all the members of the court went to one of those two places. I think five of them maybe have gone to Harvard and four of them have gone to Yale. And I recall seeing recently somewhere Justice Sotomayor was asked about that fact. And she said, oh, no, that's not true. In fact, Justice Ginsburg actually spent a year in law school at Columbia, and then she paused a moment and she said, yeah, she was slumming it.
Right, yes, this was in the piece.
And of course, it's an absurd notion.
We also almost always take justices who have previously served on the Washington, D.C. District Court, Appellate Court,
right.
Which used to not be the case. We used to take people who'd been senators, who'd been had all kinds of backgrounds, much more diverse in terms of what their qualifications were. Obviously, one hoped you were getting somebody who was qualified, who had a knowledge of the law and a judicial temperament. But this retreat to expertise, and it's not entirely a bad thing. I mean, there's something to be said for having people who really know the law. But at the same time, This retreat into expertise, I think, has been kind of a reaction as well to this contentiousness of the last 40, 50 years. That is, if you can nominate someone who truly has a sterling resume, you can maybe immunize them from these challenges that have become more common.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Greenberg of Rutgers University all about the confirmation, the failed confirmation of Robert Bork for the United States Supreme Court all the way back in the 1980s. After the break, we'll continue our discussion, but I've also got a special treat for you, and you're just going to have to wait to hear what it is. Okay, you've waited the requisite 30 seconds. I do have a special treat for you. You may recall, if you've been listening since the beginning of the show, you may recall that when I was first talking to David Greenberg about this Bork nomination, I was reminded somewhat unexpectedly of the fact that there was a best-selling novel all the way back in 1959, one that I happened to love, called Advise and Consent. And as the title suggests, it was all about a Senate confirmation. In that case, it was Secretary of State. But hey, same difference, as they say. And even better, they made it into a movie starring one of my favorite actors of all time, Charles Laughton. In fact, I think this was his last role. Now, in this particular clip that I'm going to share with you in just a second, Charles Laughton, who is playing the part of a Southern senator opposed to the nomination, gives some of his reasons why. So just sit back and enjoy it.
Mr. President, I feel I must defend my distinguished colleague from Illinois. It appears that he is beset on every side by snarling enemies, yet it was his intention only to give voice to the simple complaint many of us feel on both sides of the aisle, an honest revulsion at this nomination the president has thrown in our teeth.
Mr. President, will this senator yield?
I will not yield, sir, but I will say for you what you'd say anyway, that this is not the time for personal imputations. Will that satisfy the senator? Was there no other man than this Robert A. Leffenwell? Is our storehouse of brain power so impoverished that for this office, which can affect the destiny of our nation and of the world, there is no other man but Robert A. Leffenwell? I find that hard, indeed impossible to believe.
Will the distinguished senator yield?
Well, now, to my young, handsome, and plenipotent colleague, I will gladly yield.
Looks like Siebe's going to have roast Leif Smith for lunch.
Does the senior senator from South Carolina think he knows more than the president about what or who is needed in these perilous times in the office of Secretary of State?
Yes, Senator. I dare say that even one so young and green as the junior senator from Rhode Island would have chosen another man, wouldn't you, Senator? Truth.
The senator assumes an infallibility of knowledge which denotes a closed mind and an aged crust of prejudice.
Wait, who?
Miss President, we have here an example of the commotion this man Leffenwell can arouse. Able, sensitive young senators, taught courtesy at their mother's knees, turn upon their elders and rend them because of their passions over this disturbing man, Robert A. Leffenwell. I beseech senators to contemplate the spectacle we are making of ourselves. Why? What is causing this bitterness of division in our party, Leffenwell? Who is disrupting cordial flow of legislative interchange, Leffenwell? Who is turning this Senate into a cockpit of angry emotion, Leffenwell? I abominate this man, Leffenwell. He is an evil man. He will pursue a policy of appeasement. He will weaken the moral fiber of our great nation. He will bring destruction to our traditions. And I beg you, senators, reject him. Reject him.
Wasn't that fantastic? Charles Laughton playing Senator Seabright B. Cooley of South Carolina in the movie Advise and Consent. The book was written by a fellow named Alan Drury, who was a journalist in Washington, D.C. prior to writing it, and it led to a number of sequels which are less known but equally worth your attention. So once again, Advise and Consent. Go to your library. That's that big building with all the books in it. Go to your library and check it out. But now it's time to get back to Professor David Greenberg of Rutgers University, and we were just talking about the process of modern Senate confirmations, how they've changed since the Bork nomination, and how unfortunate it is that people don't take on the issue of ideology directly, but instead they try to attack people with whom they disagree ideologically simply by attacking their credentials. And what this seems to have led to is a sort of an arms race in terms of academic qualifications, to the point where our current Supreme Court only has people from Harvard and Yale on it. I mean, those are fine schools, but there are lots of fine schools out there. And it has a couple of nasty consequences. It leads to perhaps a bit more narrowness in terms of at least the academic preparation of the bench. And it also leads maybe to a certain narrower view. I realize there's a great ideological diversity on the court right now, so maybe that argument doesn't wash, but maybe another argument does, the one that you simply are excluding views that are indigenous to other parts of the country or to different social classes, perhaps. I recall that one of the most eloquent writers on the Supreme Court was Robert Jackson, and if I recall correctly, he never went to law school at all, did he? I think he read for the law.
I don't know about Jackson. That might be right. Certainly we have had a number of justices who didn't go to law school because, for a long time it wasn't even the norm. You would train kind of apprentice or read law. And we also, if you think about Earl Warren, was a governor.
Yeah.
He had been attorney general too. But there were many, for most of our history, Supreme Court justices were presumed to come from a range of different backgrounds. People sometimes went on and off the court. Jimmy Burns under Truman or Arthur Goldberg leaves under Johnson to become U.N. ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
People had a hand in politics, and now we really want to sort of insulate the court entirely from politics, which, again, there's a reasonable impulse behind it, but it does both narrow the pool of possible judges and also, I think, kind of narrow the thinking or the life experience that is brought to the high court.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. Oh, well, but people see questioning qualifications as a way to get rid of someone with whom their real disagreement is ideological, or alternately, they see people with really impressive resumes as being bulletproof from that kind of challenge.
Exactly. So in a way, the rhetoric of expertise is a kind of fictional or phony discourse that is masking what I think everybody really knows, which is that these are political appointments. One hopes they're not only political appointments, that is to say, you don't pick a justice as president only because of how you think they will vote on key cases, but that is obviously the main or the first consideration. I mean, there's no way that, Obama is going to deliberately nominate a very conservative judge, no matter how impressive his resume, and just as Bush was never going to nominate a very liberal judge. But we still kind of pretend otherwise.
Yeah, and it is a fiction, and it's an unfortunate fiction too. I mean, I guess I understand that the court feels like it gains some institutional legitimacy when it characterizes itself as being above politics, and when it calls the other branches the political branches, but exempts itself from that label. But as you point out, it is political, and it's certainly political, at least in the sense of ideology. And you're right, no president is going to pick somebody with whom he fundamentally disagrees on matters of constitutional interpretation. You said one other thing that I'll comment on, or at least deliberately. That's one of the truisms of the court, is that, once these people have been advised and consented to by the Senate, they're on there pretty much for life if they want to be, and they don't always behave themselves, do they?
Well, that's right. Now, there's a little bit of a myth about that. More often than not, you know what you're getting. So the notion that there's really no guessing where they're going to go is overstating it. All that said, there have been many cases of presidents regretting their choices. Certainly Dwight Eisenhower,
yes.
Who lately seems to be, liberals seem to be enamored of him, who was a real conservative, he regretted the appointments of Warren and of Justice Brennan. He felt they were too liberal. Richard Nixon regretted some of his appointments, like Harry Blackmun, who turned out to, be much more liberal, certainly as his career progressed and, was the wrote the opinion in Roe v. Wade upholding a right to an abortion. So there have been regrets by presidents, and probably the most recent one, I guess, was David Souter, who George Bush nominated with assurances from people like John Sununu that he was going to be, you know, a true conservative. And, of course, he ended up fairly quickly casting most of his votes with what we can call the liberal wing of the court. However, you know, besides Souter, we haven't had any of the other recent justices show that kind of independence. I suppose some people saw John Roberts' vote in the health care case last year as some kind of apostasy.
Oh, yes, the traitor chief justice, yes, who had for somehow been corrupted. Yes, I remember all of that rhetoric.
Right, and, you know, we'll see. I mean, my own guess is that this term he will, you know, revert to being a more reliable conservative vote. On the other hand, he could surprise us, and that last vote could have been the beginning of a shift in his jurisprudence. I remain skeptical of that suggestion.
Well, there's an old quote, I think, it's at least attributed to Muhammad Ali, as that the person who thinks the same way or believes the same things at the age of 50 as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years. And,
right,
you know,
yes,
that's got to be true of judges, too, right? I mean, they're human beings. We sometimes forget that. They wear those black robes, and they seem so impressive up there. But if you're going to appoint someone and expect that person to be on the bench for decades, then there's going to be some change. But I will go back to your basic premise, and I will agree with it, is that by and large, ideology is important. And presidents are looking for people with whom they generally agree, and generally speaking, they get what they think they're going to get.
Right. And it's entirely appropriate, as a result, for Congress to say, look, you know, the last X number of appointments to the bench have, you know, been very conservative, and we don't think it's appropriate to, you know, appoint X, you know, whoever it is, Roberts or Alito, in this environment, because this is going to tip the balance. And you did hear some of those arguments with Roberts and Alito, because Sandra Day O'Connor was stepping down and she was a swing vote, so this was seen as tipping the balance. And, you know, by the same token, I think it's legitimate for conservative senators to object, and I think they ought to be forthright, though, in saying, look, this is We object to this person's jurisprudence, that they tend to rule in a liberal direction that we think is wrong for the country, and I think that's permissible, you know, and it's partly what was expected. You don't, you know, expect senators to do it out of a personal vendetta, but some consideration. If the president is considering the ideology, or, you know, at least the nature of the jurisprudence, so should the Senate.
Yeah, and I seem to recall that's exactly what happened during the Bork hearings. Now, I don't mean to come in and you know, and get political or, you know, take positions, but what I recall of those confirmation hearings, there was a great deal of questioning about judicial philosophy. And I seem to recall, wasn't it led by Senator Specter at the time? I think it was. At any rate, I mean, that...
Yeah, I mean, I'm forgetting if he was chairing. I remember him vividly from the Clarence Thomas hearings just a few years later.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, certainly these questions of judicial philosophy and of key bellwether court cases were the main, you know, bone of contention. And the fact that Robert Bork had been against the Civil Rights Act, the fact that he was against the Griswold decision ensuring a right to privacy in matters of birth control, these were legitimate, you know, issues. And, you know, the opponent's argument was, if Ronald Reagan is choosing to nominate somebody who comes from, you know, a kind of, I would say, ideological right wing, but also a kind of particularly this kind of intellectual haven where he was kind of involved in theorizing some you know, quite extreme views, it's very legitimate for the senators to take that into consideration, too. And it's interesting, if you look at the record, there were a number of more conservative Southern Democrats, people like Hal Heflin and Pryor from Arkansas, who made statements to the effect, look, I have supported conservative justices. I supported Justice O'Connor's appointment. I support it. And they said, but Bork is different. You know, Bork to them lay outside the bounds, a kind of certain permissible scope of freedom that you might grant the president. And they were quite reflective and thoughtful in how they chose to demarcate those boundaries of what they believed to be beyond the pale. This wasn't random. This wasn't, you know, arbitrary in choosing Bork as somebody to vote down. It was a direct reflection of what his views and writings said.
Yeah, and it was very much not a decision that he was in some sense unqualified professionally. I mean, I think everybody there recognized that he was a man of experience, a man of great education, a man of great intelligence, a man who certainly had an intellectual basis for his views. In fact, I believe he described the prospect of being on the Supreme Court as an intellectual feast that he was looking forward to. So no one thought that the guy was dumb or that he wasn't qualified in a resume sense. It seems that they just really and truly disagreed with where he wanted to take the court.
Right, and the fact that he was manifestly qualified in terms of his resume, I think, made it impossible for his opponents to resort, as they might have otherwise, in some of the Nixon cases, to charges that he was mediocre. That was a word that got thrown around a lot with Nixon's failed nomination of Harold Carswell, that he was mediocre. So you could vote against him on those grounds. You didn't have to get into his views. With Bork, the issue was joined of his views because you couldn't resort to unqualified or mediocre. You also, they didn't resort to scandal. That's another favorite tactic. If you don't want to come out and say you're against him ideologically, you try to dig up some scandals, and with Alito and even with Stephen Breyer, you know, people fished around for small little things that they thought might have some ethical implications, and usually those don't take off. With William Rehnquist, there was the question of restrictive racial covenant, where he, you know, agreed not to sell his home to blacks or Jews, you know, and this was somewhat more concerning. But ultimately, you know, with Bork, you had to join it on the issues. I also think that comment of his about the intellectual feast was part of what people found troubling. There was a kind of air of unreality to Bork, that he was concerned with sort of the pure logic of the ideas without concern of how his rulings might affect people's lives.
Yeah, he did not come off as warm and fuzzy. Yeah, he definitely did not come off as
warm and fuzzy, yeah. But also that his kind of cerebral approach to the law would not be appropriate for the court. That just what we were saying a few moments ago about the absence of politicians and people with other kinds of backgrounds and experience. Somebody who approached these things purely as an intellectual puzzle doesn't fully appreciate what the job is about. I think that was an argument that was made against Bork. I mean, one can argue that either way. You could say, no, the justices should only think about the consistency of the application of the law. But I think many more people agree that they also have to think about the particular people and how interpretations of the law will affect different citizens.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Greenberg from Rutgers University all about the federal nomination process, specifically the federal nomination process that rejected Robert Bork for the United States Supreme Court. After the break, we'll come back and we'll talk some more with David Greenberg, and then we have a special treat. We've got our local U.S. attorney from the Western District of Virginia who had a surprising connection to the Bork hearings. Stick around. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Professor David Greenberg about Borking Bork, the failed judicial nomination of Robert Bork to the United States Supreme Court. We were just talking about another judicial confirmation proceeding that actually had two rejections before resulting in the ultimate confirmation of Justice Harry Blackmun. You mentioned Harold Carswell, as being rejected
right.
as a mediocrity, supposedly, after President Nixon nominated him. Prior to Carswell, of course, there was Clement Haynsworth, who had also been rejected. And eventually, as you pointed out, this resulted in the appointment of, I believe it was Harry Blackmun. And Harry Blackmun, ever after, referred to himself as old number three. Because he had been Nixon's, not his first, not his second, but only his third choice to be on the Supreme Court. But, of course, in that case, the third time was the charm. But it showed a laudable humility, I thought, with Justice Blackmun when he referred to himself
right.
that
and
way.
And one could say the same thing of Anthony Kennedy, whatever one thinks of him as a justice.
Mm-hmm.
After Bork, there was Douglas Ginsburg, who was forced to withdraw after reports of his having used marijuana, not just as a student, but as a professor and with mm-hmm. students. In retrospect, that kind of marijuana test that we used to subject presidential candidates and other officials to seems to be a product of its time and somewhat overdrawn. But perhaps it, too, was a way of trying to strike down an unpalatable nominee without digging in directly to the question of ideology. And as a result, Reagan, on the third try, did put up somebody who was a bit more moderate. I mean, I think Kennedy still, everybody would call him a conservative, but he has, on a number of issues, declined to go with the conservative majority, and particularly when O'Connor was on the bench, he and O'Connor would often in key cases join with the liberal wing. So again, the third time was the charm.
It's kind of funny, if you grant your premise that we really just should openly acknowledge the importance of ideology and the importance of politics, really, in these appointments, and if we confined ourselves primarily to that discussion, then actually it's starting to sound like maybe the Bork confirmation hearings were a model of what you're looking for.
Well, I think there's something to be said for that. I mean, the other thing I think that does trouble people about the Bork case, which I grant to some degree, is it kind of became a media circus. And that was somewhat different from Thurgood Marshall and Abe Fortas's case, which we haven't discussed. I mean, the Fortas case was quite a media firestorm. But you didn't have the same 24/7 television coverage that you started to have by the 1980s.
Mm-hmm.
So the Bork case unfolds in this more intense media climate that I think in some ways ratcheted up pressure on all sides. And to the degree that people objected to the kind of partisan intensity that took hold, I can share some of those laments. However, I do think it's better to see what you saw with Bork, which is questioning about his views, than questioning, Sam Alito about some investments that he made, which nobody really thinks are grounds for keeping him off the bench or, this kind of thing. I mean, there's all kinds of niggling gotcha politics that start to enter into it that really aren't such a good use of the senator's time, the public's time, the media's time. I would much rather have, you know, a fully aired discussion about Griswold versus Connecticut and Roe versus Wade or other rulings. The Miranda ruling was a big controversial one for a long time. And whether these, were good law or bad law and why. That is what we should be talking about with potential Supreme Court justices.
Yeah, and so often they will hide behind the idea that they don't want to say anything that's going to prejudge or prejudice any future decisions they might make on the bench. And yet I think that's probably an overstated concern because people aren't going to ask them about particular pending cases. They're going to ask them about important cases of the past and basic ideological questions. And so I think probably
yeah, well, exactly.
There's a lot.
Exactly. So it became something of a joke when Clarence Thomas was asked about Roe v. Wade.
And he said he'd never read it.
Opinion on the matter. Said he's probably the only person in America who didn't have an opinion on Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and maybe he said he didn't have an opinion. Yeah,
plausible.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if he said he hadn't read it or if he simply didn't have an opinion on it. But he claimed ignorance, one way or the other, or at least complete. Go ahead.
It's sort of like we get into with juries. You want people who know nothing about some case to be on a jury. Well, it's a way of guaranteeing a certain degree of ignorance. In this case, I don't think it was guaranteeing ignorance. It was just guaranteeing a certain disingenuousness.
Yeah, and in fact,
the Thomas case, I think, would have been much better if it had been honestly fought on grounds of ideology rather than sexual harassment. I think, that Senate Judiciary Committee was not the place to be discussing whether he was a sexual harasser. I mean, that may or may not be a legitimate question to disqualify him in the first place, but it's not the ideal forum for.
No, it's really not, and I'm glad you mentioned Clarence Thomas because I've been thinking about that. I'm sure that Clarence Thomas would much rather have talked about his judicial philosophy candidly. And been challenged on it openly, then he would have endured what he did endure. And this was, of course, a rather unpleasant, sordid inquiry. And it boiled down to a very frustrating he said, she said. And I'm not going to take sides on this. It's obviously a very important question whether someone's engaged in sexual harassment. But as you point out, this is not the ideal forum. I mean, you don't have discovery. You don't have the same degree of ability to have a trial. I mean, sexual harassment is something that ideally should be taken into a trial courtroom and with a judge and a jury and all the procedural protections and all the preparations that might take months to get ready for, rather than something that's brought up perhaps unexpectedly in something that's supposed to take a very short period of time.
Well, that's exactly right. And if I recall correctly, there were sort of two rounds of hearings on Thomas that I think the core sexual harassment allegations came up after sort of an initial round of hearings had concluded, and then it was sort of reopened to take on this particular issue. I as listeners might guess, my own political views are not those of Clarence Thomas. But I do think in some ways he has gotten unfairly treated. Again, not to take sides in the he said, she said, where I do tend to believe Anita Hill's allegations, but mistreated in the rap against his qualifications to be on the bench and making fun of the fact that he never talks at oral argument and so on, that he really has kind of been treated disrespectfully as a sitting justice. And, he may not have been, the most qualified, most superlative choice for the Supreme Court, when Thurgood Marshall retired. I don't think he was, but that doesn't mean he's unqualified. And I think he has endured a lot of kind of unfair ridicule in the media and elsewhere.
Well, I know we're running out of time here. Before we go, there was one last point you made in your op-ed piece that I just I really thought crystallized your argument, and that was you wrote, in 1795, the Senate rejected George Washington's nominee for Chief Justice, John Rutledge, largely because of his view on the 1794 peace treaty with Britain. George Washington had his nominee for Chief Justice rejected. I think that kind of says it all.
That's right. And I believe, if I'm not wrong, Rutledge was already on the bench at the time as a recess appointment. So it was even all the more of a rejection. And, yeah, this only shows what I think historians know and legal scholars know, but you know, members of the news media forget, and the general public often forget, which is that both the constitutional expectation and the norms for much of our history have been for Congress, for the Senate, to aggressively question and even challenge and even reject nominees to the Supreme Court as well as to other political offices, and that while any individual can do so for legitimate or illegitimate motives, the mere act of voting these people down or having a public fight about, you know, the wisdom of the appointment is not a bad thing, but a good thing. It's part of how our democracy works.
Sometimes when you're asked to advise and consent, you say no.
That's exactly right.
Well, David Greenberg of Rutgers University, thank you so very much for speaking with us on your Weekly Constitutional.
Thanks. My pleasure to be on the show.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I've been speaking with Professor David Greenberg of Rutgers University all about the controversial nomination, the failed nomination of Robert Bork to the United States Supreme Court. And that was a great conversation. But recently, just by sheerest coincidence, I happened across a fellow who had a personal knowledge of that process. His name is Tim Hafey, and he was visiting the Appalachian School of Law because we're within his territory. He is the United States Attorney for the Western District of Virginia, and he came out and spoke at our law school, spoke in my constitutional law classes. Wonderful fellow, and in fact, I'll give you a little foreshadowing here. We're going to have him on a later episode, and he's going to tell us all about his duties as United States Attorney and the confirmation process that he personally had to go through. But that's for a later episode. Now, we're just going to play a snippet, just a few minutes from that interview, because that's when we talked about his personal experience as a member of the staff of Senator Joe Biden, who was at that time the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Between college and law school, I spent a year teaching high school, and then I spent a year working on Senator Biden's personal staff. I was a volunteer on his presidential campaign, but when that ended in September of 87, I moved into a job on his Senate staff. So that was the time, Stuart, when the Bork confirmation hearing was going on. He literally dropped out of the presidential race one of the first mornings of the hearings that he was chairing. He was chairman of Judiciary. And as a matter of fact, he told us, when he gathered us and told us that he was going to withdraw from the presidential race, I was still on the campaign staff. He said, I cannot continue to run for president with this distraction and chair the Bork hearings. That was such a significant event in our history.
This was 92, right?
This was 87.
Oh, forgive my ignorance. I'm sorry, of course. I was thinking of the Thomas hearings.
Hearings were later. This was in 87.
Right, okay.
He made a choice between running for president and stepping off of the committee chairmanship, or keeping the committee chairmanship and stepping out of the presidential race. And I think he made the right decision and stayed as chairman of the committee. And he explained to us when he dropped out that, you know, he had made some careless mistakes. He had used some speech quotes that had been unattributed from Bobby Kennedy and from Neil Kinnock, the British politician, and, you know, president can't be that careless. And he was very sort of honest about the fact that these mistakes were in his own mind significant enough that he needed to step out of the race. But he encouraged us to stay involved in politics. I'll never forget his talk the morning that he's about to face the national press. He said, "Don't let what happened to me make you cynical about politics. Don't make it a distaste that means you turn away from this as an occupation. You know, politics is a good thing. You should work for other candidates and believe in the power of government to help people." So he had the ability to give this kind of stirring, motivational talk to his young staff, even when he was in the midst of this personal, very difficult day. So I've always had a lot of respect for the vice president. I didn't work with him very closely, nowhere near as closely as I did with Eric Holder, but I was on his staff. And then I saw the Bork hearings up close, and I think that's what you were
Tell me about that.
It was a circus. I mean, it was the biggest thing that I saw during my time there. The stakes were extremely high. People on both sides really geared up. The liberal opposition to Judge Bork was so pronounced, and the view that you heard from them was that he was extreme and radical and would change the complexion of the Supreme Court in a way that would eviscerate individual rights. And his writings, his opinions, everything was picked through, and there was a lot of opposition to Bork. And on the other side, given that he was such a sort of conservative leading light, there was a lot of support for him. And the Senate was closely divided politically. Biden, it was a Democratic-controlled Senate, and Biden was chairman of the committee, but it was pretty close. So the hearings were, you know, lengthy and intense, and I wasn't working, staffing him on those issues. I was on his personal staff at the time. But I recall it feeling momentous and feeling like, you know, this was a historical fork. And I can't say that I thought it was inappropriate. I mean, I do think now some of what we see with judicial nominations seems excessive, or the delay, the scrutiny, the holdup. But I didn't think that was. I do think that was an ideological discussion about constitutional theory. And I think that's appropriate. I think there are people nominated for positions that have perspectives that are polarizing, or that are even, by some definitions, extreme. And Bork was one of them. I mean, he was such an intellectual force. There's no question that he was qualified. It was more a question of, is the Senate going to endorse his constitutional theory?
Very interesting. You've mentioned the process today. Do you have any thoughts on the judicial confirmation process today, where we stand?
Yeah, unfortunately, since Bork, I think the process has gotten more politicized and has gummed up too much. You know, one senator now can essentially hold up the consideration of an executive or judicial nominee from coming to the floor. He or she can file a blue slip and can literally say, I am not satisfied with the information I've been provided.
A blue slip? What is a blue slip?
I guess it goes back to the actual document that the senator would post or would place somewhere to indicate that he was unwilling to have this proceed to the consideration of the full Senate.
And that, so one senator one out of 100 can just stop?
Yeah. What?
Isn't that remarkable? Just one senator can now hold up judicial nominations, and they do so. And unfortunately, that leads to all kinds of delays and vacancies in our federal judiciary, and it has a lot of negative impacts. We don't have time to go into all of that with Tim Hafey right now, but I do promise we're going to have much of the rest of his interview in a later episode. In the meantime, I'd like to thank him for his contribution to this episode. I'd also like to thank Professor David Greenberg of Rutgers University, who told us all about Borking Bork. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My assistant today, who helped me introduce this episode, is my former student, Joni Burrows. Our distribution engineers are Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are part of the American experiment.